Hello and welcome back to another edition of Podcast from the Edge with me, Peter Bruce. I thought that since Finance Minister Enoch Godongwana is getting an eye-watering third shot at producing a national budget that Parliament, let alone the courts, might finally accept, it might be useful to try and enter the hallowed precincts of the National Treasury, where it all will be happening, and to try and form a picture of what is in fact going on. Godongwana has given himself until May 21st, just 10 days or so away now, to produce a completely reworked budget, now that he knows for sure he can't simply slap a VAT increase on us to cover the sins of low or no growth. I'm assuming that there are some pretty colourful discussions going on in the Treasury, and I'm really happy to say that Jabulani Sikhakane, who was Treasury spokesman for the late Pravin Gordhan when he was Finance Minister, is joining me today. A word about Jabulani Sikhakane. He's one of the great business and financial journalists in South Africa for the past 25 years. He suffers from an inability to not research his every word, and in a media world long ago crumbled to reporting statements and statistics, he still does the reading and the research required to always give him an edge. He's now editor of The Conversation, the local South African edition of a really awesome global network of expert and academic thought and research, edited for non-academic consumption. And to listeners who may not have found The Conversation yet online, do yourself a favor and go look for it. It's easy to find and great to read. I'm also pleased to say Jabulani writes a weekly column in Business Day where, in his own gentle way, he pulls no punches. Last week, he called for Enoch Godongwana's resignation, citing a loss of credibility over the VAT failures. And Jabulani, while a lot of people, including me, and I see Boni Mtomboti in the Sunday Times agree with you, it seems President Cyril Ramaphosa doesn't agree.
That is definitely my view, that the mishandling of the VAT issue would in most democracies have result in the Minister of Finance stepping down.
And what has happened here? Why do you think he hasn't? I mean, there's not even the remotest little bit of pressure by the looks of it for him to go. I mean, not from the markets, not from his own, not from the people around him, not from the party, not from the opposition even, really. He's, you know, you're right. I mean, I think, you know, it's extraordinary. But he's in place and he's going to be doing budget number three.
Well, I suppose, Peter, that the two factors at play. One, Ramaphosa knows that if Godongwana goes, there's going to be contestation, certainly within his own party, about who becomes the next finance minister or who replaces Godongwana, right? So you don't want that because in terms of your own party, even though, I mean, it's just slightly over 40% of our seats in parliament, but it's still the largest party, and even in the government of national unity. So you don't want to open that contestation. Certainly almost halfway through your last term of office, as the president, right? So, because it will expose you to a whole range of, problems that you don't want to deal with. I mean, I think President Ramaphosa has been under pressure from his own party on a whole range of other issues.
Yes,
I don't think he wants to add to that. So then that may be his thinking, right? Secondly, I think the problem is that if you get a new finance minister, or if you were to get a new finance minister now, it might take that person a bit of time to kind of to get things going, which might then add to the uncertainty, right? So the financial markets might say, well, better the devil you know than kind of a new person coming in and then that person taking quite some time to settle.
So it's basically he's happy to limp along. Probably not happy to limp along, but in many respects he is limping along, because there's no question that Godongwana, and to an extent the Treasury too, is damaged by this whole VAT affair.
Yeah, no, there's no doubt. I mean, there are two problem areas. The first one is that Godongwana has had two opportunities for dealing with this matter. Obviously, in the run up to the normal sort of budget tabling in February, that kind of the issue of VAT was not handled properly, right? The consultation wasn't done.
Yeah.
as it should have been done. That's become clear. Then he has a second opportunity in March. Then also that fails in terms of what he presented, obviously including the court case that the DA and the other parties brought against his proposed kind of 1 percentage point increase in VAT. So question becomes whether the 21 days that he has, well, it's now less than 21 days that he has before he tables the third budget or the third iteration of the 2025-26 budget, whether it will be enough for him, one, to repair the damage that has been done politically to the budget process, and in other words, and be able to do all of the necessary consultations that need to be done to get the budget through, right? Because some other parties are going to hold out, right? A different deal. Obviously, the biggest battle now is no longer on the revenue side. It's more on the expenditure because he has said that, well, if now that I can't get the money I was expecting to get by raising VAT, I then need to cut expenditure. So where is he going to cut?
So, I mean, Jabulani, just talk about the damage done that you mentioned earlier on. I mean, so he's got to repair the damage and he's got to prepare a cogent political damage and the damage to the Treasury, and he's got to find the cuts, right? So just talk about the damage for a little bit. What is it? What is the damage? Is it repairable? Is it just, is it in our heads or is it real?
Well, the damage is real. I also use the word damage kind of cautiously because some of the things that arise from the mishandling of the VAT proposal are that he has opened the door to a whole range of institutions that since 1994 have had very limited say or influence in the budget process. So, for example, if you take the parliament as a whole, if you take the parliamentary budget office, you take civil society and related institutions, they've kind of made submissions over the years, but I think it's going to be this year is the first time that all of those institutions have kind of suddenly woken up to the fact that they do have power and that they can use that power to squeeze for whatever they would like to see being done to the budget. You know, Parliament, perhaps for the first time in since 1994, you know, might or will exercise the power to change the budget and tell the Minister of Finance, okay, you can't cut over there on that expenditure line item. You must cut over there, kind of thing. So which means the kind of influence or power, if you like, that the Minister of Finance has exercised, obviously, I mean, on behalf of Cabinet, over the years, is being whittled down. Because the ability to change the budget, I doubt that that's a power that Parliament will then exercise this year and then come next year and say, okay, right, no, we're not going to exercise it, right?
Yes.
So, so similarly with other institutions, whether they be civil society groupings, NGOs, and even political parties, by the way. So that's the kind of damage I'm talking about, because I doubt that we will have kind of the kind of budget processes that we've heard up until last year. So onwards, that's going to change. So, now the question is whether the Ministry of Finance and Treasury are prepared for the kind of changes that the handling of the VAT issue has brought about. Already, by the way, I mean, there have been all sorts of pressure, particularly in the last 2-3 years, that have been coming from NGOs and other civil society institutions.
What's your view? Do you think they are prepared?
Well, it requires quite some serious rethink of how you run the budget process as a budget process coordinator, you know, at Treasury, right? And also the structure of the budget process itself might have to change. Change to what? I'm not sure at this stage, but that will require some changes in terms of how you run your budget process. Because remember, historically, Minister of Finance will table the budget in February. By April, May, the Treasury team is already beginning to lay the foundations for the following year's budget. Now, it's the budget that the Minister of Finance will table in February the following year. Now, what this VAT debacle has done, it has kind of, it's pushing things out a bit because they still need to deal with the 2025-26 budget, and they will be occupied with that maybe till June, early July. So when do they start?
You know, do you think, Jabulani, that the Treasury has maintained the sort of intellectual muscle and capacity that it's going to, that it needs?
It still has. I mean, the intellectual capital that's in place. Yes, there may be weaknesses here and there, but there are still people who do a very decent job, I think, of the budget process. The main issue here, I think, is more political than technical, right? I don't think one can worry too much about the technical expertise. Well, it can be improved, but it's more political. It's more the political damage. Historically, I mean, the Treasury was, or the Ministry of Finance stroke Treasury was a very strong institution. It had a kind of very strong, powerful, I think, political standing in the entire system of government. So what we still have to see, what has the VAT mishandling done to that standing of the Treasury, both politically and otherwise, within government and outside government as well?
Do you think, I mean, one of the things that's arisen as a result of all of this has been an argument, and I think it might have been made first by Songe Zozibi, that there is a limit to the amount of criticism that the Treasury should be exposed to. In other words, you know, the Treasury, unlike any other department of government, is actually in the Constitution. It's a very important institution, and along with the Reserve Bank, they're the two pillars of our economic stability in a turbulent world. And the argument goes that to criticize Gorongwana or the Treasury is to toy or put at risk the very stability of a vital institution. Do you buy that?
No, I don't. Simply because, I mean, to whom much power is given, much is expected. So, I mean, we criticize the judiciary, right? So why wouldn't we criticize the Reserve Bank or Treasury? I mean, the judiciary is a creature of the Constitution too.
So I
don't think, I mean, the two institutions, the Reserve Bank and the National Treasury or stroke Ministry of Finance, should be protected from criticism, right? So long as people are making kind of valid arguments. In other words, the statements are not being made out of pure malice about these institutions, right? If, for example, I mean, I apply for a banking license, I get turned down. Yeah, you know, if I then have a crime in that sense, I will agree. Yeah. But to disagree with the Reserve Bank or the National Treasury about the policy trajectory or the decisions that are making is very healthy for democracy. It can't be any other way.
I suppose to one extent, though, you do need to be aware of the fact that institutions like the Treasury, like the Reserve Bank, need to attract the best and the brightest. And sometimes, you know, you might be quite a sensitive soul and would rather not have the kind of criticism thrown at you and rather go and work, you know, in a bank where you make much more money and not have to deal with the politics of the country.
Well, I doubt that that will be a major issue because, you know, people who work in these institutions, they take
tough?
the job on the understanding that it's public service, right? And in public service, I mean, people are going to disagree with what you are doing. And in any case, it's incumbent upon these institutions to explain themselves to the public.
Yeah.
On whose behalf they are doing what they do. So in the process of explaining themselves to the public, you know, people will disagree with them. That's healthy, right? And they need to take that in that spirit. Bar the kind of stuff, I mean, that's malicious, that some people would say for kind of a variety of reasons. Otherwise, I mean, public comment about what these two institutions do should be subject to public scrutiny, right? So some of that scrutiny may not be informed kind of by facts. It may, people may be just responding, you know, out of
emotionally,
based on a misunderstanding either of the mandate of the Reserve Bank or on what the mandate of the Treasury is or what the Treasury is trying to do. But I think that's part of and parcel of how this system works. So they should focus more on explaining to the public what they do and why they do it.
Can I just, in the terms of the minister himself or herself, does it matter who it is? I mean, obviously, you know, Des van Rooyen was stretching it a bit too far. But I mean, you know, all you really need, surely, is a vaguely sensible person who lets his or her officials get on with their jobs and do the work and produce the budget. You just read it out, or is there some real leadership required there?
Now, there is definitely quite a great deal of leadership that's required. In some instances, that leadership is to buy political cover for Treasury officials. Because of all kind of government departments, bar the presidency, the National Treasury or stroke Ministry of Finance is the most political of all kind of government departments, in the sense that if politics, I mean, is about who gets what, where, when, and how and when, then it's Treasury actually that kind of puts the flesh on those bones. So it will be the most political of all government departments. So you do need somebody who can, say, for example, buy political cover for Treasury officials, somebody who can go to cabinet and for lack of a better word, fight with his cabinet colleagues for what's sensible. Regarding both revenue and expenditure, and also push back, because you know, cabinet ministers who are not ministers of finance, they don't worry about the management of the country's finances, and they just put a wish list of what. Of what they want. To be done, because they want to be remembered. For having done something, they want to be remembered for all the ribbons that they cut and the front pages of the media that they get. But the Minister of Finance is the one who needs to watch that and fight with his cabinet colleagues if necessary over it.
So your experience inside the Treasury now, they've got basically 10 more days, a bit more than that, to deliver a budget. As you say, version 3. Business Day is reporting last week that the head of the budget office, Edgar Shishi, is on a 6-month sabbatical and won't be returning to help. What do you imagine is going on inside the National Treasury right now? I mean, are they is it feverish? Is it calm, relaxed? Is it slightly tense? Lots of meetings, lots of closed doors. What try and paint a picture for listeners what it might be like to be in the Treasury at a moment like this?
Well, it should be quite intense, because obviously they have to address the expenditure side of the budget in terms of what had been proposed either in February or proposed in March now, which was the second iteration of the budget. So what do you take out? And then secondly, obviously, they have to revise economic growth. And the question becomes, if there are any revisions to economic growth, what does that mean for the revenue side? You forecasting lower tax revenue collection, which might mean, are you going to trim more on the expenditure side than what the proposed VAT increase was going to deliver, right? Because if you have your revenue declining and you also want to maintain a certain level of debt to GDP and you won't go too high above that, you have to cut expenditure. But cutting expenditure might not be politically palatable with a number of constituencies, depending on what is it that you're proposing to cut. So the challenge there is that there can be any number of permutations that could come from Treasury officials, but they are not the politicians. Yeah. So the Minister of Finance is the one who has to go before Cabinet, before his Cabinet colleagues, and then make a case for what's being proposed, right? The question becomes, has he given the Treasury officials, what is his reading of the political mood at the moment, of what's doable, what's achieved?
And the outlook is worse than when they did now, is worse than when they did budget version one, isn't it?
Yeah, it's much worse. It's much worse than when they did.
So if they thought they were looking for $75 billion with the VAT increase, they're probably now going to have to find some more. One of the options, I suppose, and this is an interesting thing about finance ministers, because while they're very powerful, they don't really make policy. You know, so it's not as if Treasury can come up and say, well, let's sell Transnet, you know, and that'll cover us for 20 years or whatever it might be. They can't sell anything to raise money.
Yeah, that's the challenge. The minister can propose to his colleagues, but ultimately,
it's not his decision.
And secondly, you also start entering the terrain of the president, because some of these things have huge implications for the standing of the president within his own party too. So.
Yeah. Well, that's an interesting thing. So where does the finance minister sit politically in South Africa? They don't have to be particularly senior in ANC. Pravin Gordhan wasn't particularly senior. Trevor Manuel got a very good vote many years ago in the NEC. I think he was number one on the NEC list at one stage. But it's the relationship between the president and the finance minister that seems important. If you take Thabo Mbeki and Trevor Manuel, that was such a solid relationship, and presumably where does Enoch Godongwana sit? I mean, if he were to go, let's say he said, I'm sick of it, I'm not well, and I'll present the budget and then somebody else can take it on from there, would that be a shock to the system? I mean, would the markets tumble, or would it be a worry? Who else does the ANC have, and who would be? You said there would be contestation. Who would be up for it? Barbara Creasy, Senzo Mchunu. There are lots of named people here, but I don't know who's real and who's not.
Yeah, look, it's a challenge. I mean, many years ago, towards the end of Pravin's tenure as the finance minister, I think ahead of the 2014 elections, if I remember, was it 2014 or 2014? I think. Right. There was talk that Zweli Mkhize might be the next finance minister.
Yeah.
Right. On the basis that he had run the finances, he had been MEC for finance.
He was the treasurer.
Yeah.
He was party treasurer.
Of the ANC. And obviously, I mean, what's happened since would kind of write him off, given that scandal about the tender during COVID, the communications tender. It will make it very difficult justifying putting him in charge of the country's finances, right? So that's a problem with him. Other than that, it's a very thin kind of bench, I think. There are a number of people. I mean,
I was just saying, Barbara Creasy's had some experience, I think, as a provincial financial.
Might be probably a last resort or a stopgap measure.
Yeah.
And maybe might be acceptable to most sort of within the ANC. So kind of it becomes a fallback position. Yeah. But so it's a very thin bench. Unless I mean the president goes outside of
Well, can he do that?
The NEC or the ANC.
That's what Boni Mtomboti was suggesting in the Sunday Times this week. Look outside, much like Nelson Mandela did with Derek Keyes and old apartheid bankers, really.
Well, that might be the option, but that might be contested by some within the ANC, depending who you go for. So it depends, you know, who's. Or on your kind of short list of names that you put before your kind of ANC colleagues, when the president consults, certainly the senior members of the party, whether they would go along with that. Right.
So one of the names that did occur to me was it Lungisa Fuzile, who was DG at the Treasury. I think when you were there.
Yeah.
Who's wandered off, I think, to Standard Bank.
He's at Standard Bank.
And could always be hauled back. What about another political party?
That's a possibility, but particularly from one of the smaller parties.
Yeah, well, Songezo would be one of the names that would occur to me.
Definitely. It's a possibility. I mean, Songezo is very sharp.
Yeah.
But whether what he's done over the VAT thing does kind of...
does damage him, yeah.
Or has damaged him or not, I mean, it depends on which vantage point you look at the issue.
Yeah.
So Lungisa, I mean, will be a possibility, but the question is whether he wants to come back, to the state. He might take it, I mean, as a public duty, I mean, to help move the country along. And he's a very solid sort of chap.
Absolutely.
Very kind of strict,
very impressive.
Tough. Unmovable on a whole range of issues.
No, absolutely. And he probably knows the Treasury better than many of the people who work there now. Having been DG for as long as he was.
I think, the Treasury officials would love him as kind of will rally quite easily behind him as a Minister of Finance.
Yeah.
The question is whether he can be persuaded to take on the job.
Well, there are two things. I mean, the president obviously would need to persuade Standard Bank that he was he was needed for some country duty. And if Standard Bank were to say, all right, well, as long as he comes back after three or four years or after 2029, he can go. But anyway, so listen, there's going to be a budget on the 21st, given that the DA is itself, now says it's happy because it's being consulted. What can a budget actually do, Jabulani, for growth? I mean, it can keep the country functioning and we can issue bonds and all that sort of stuff. But can it grow the economy, or can it simply facilitate? Can it simply, what can this Treasury do? What can this budget do to actually grow the amount of money that SARS can tax in the system?
Well, on its own, the tabling of a budget won't grow the economy, right? What the budget does signal is obviously the priorities in terms of expenditure. In other words, we want to fix infrastructure, right? Yeah. So then it allocates resources towards doing that. But it's the actual fixing of infrastructure that will then help grow the economy, right? Because the Minister of Finance, as you correctly pointed out earlier, is not the one who then goes out and whips municipalities into shape to get them to function properly and deliver public services as they should. He's not going to be able to fix Eskom. It's up to the Eskom management team and the board to do that. He's not going to be able to fix Transnet. That's up to Transnet management and the board. He's not going to be able to fix provinces. It's up to the people who are running the provinces to do that, right? Yeah. He can allocate resources to priority areas, and as the priority areas as per the drivers of economic growth. Yeah. But until all of these institutions to which money has been allocated, or programs to which money has been allocated, until they start moving.
Yeah.
And fixing things and building things and making them work effectively and efficiently, well, you're not going to get growth. So the budget in itself won't do that. Yeah.
So how encouraged are you then by Cyril Ramaphosa's reform program, Operation Vulindlela? I think I saw the other day an announcement that Operation Vulindlela Stage 2 is about to be launched. And really, what does that involve? Is Stage 1 now finished? All that seems to have really changed is electricity. We wait patiently for logistics to get anywhere. Where are we on reform? I mean, is Stage 2 not getting ahead of himself a little bit? I know it's got to do, it's just because the crises that are now arise, like water and other things, are so pressing. That doesn't mean to say they have to knock other reforms out the way before they're properly dealt with, surely.
The problem is that, there's been some progress in some areas. Electricity, I mean, Eskom obviously runs relatively better now today than what the situation was like 2 years ago or a year and a half ago. So there's been some improvement there, which is most welcome. But other areas have worsened. I mean, water is a much bigger problem than it was, say, 5-10 years ago. The road infrastructure cries for help, particularly at municipal and provincial levels. But even some of the national roads, they require some serious investment. Rail seems to be stuck in a number ports. Of areas. The ports do work in some instances, but there continues to be some problems in other areas. And then overall, just the ability to move goods from the factory to a warehouse somewhere and from the warehouse to a retail outlet is also problematic. I mean, there are other issues around security, goods that fall off the trucks whilst they're being moved from point A to point B, there are all those issues. So, and then there's the perennial kind of skills issue. That we've not been able to crack in any meaningful way as a country. Yes, there may be pockets of things that are working, but it's nothing kind of systematic enough to move kind of economic growth into a much higher level. I mean, I see on social media and other platforms quite a lot of advertisements by the private sector for services that should be coming from municipalities, for example, like water machinery that's being sold by the private sector for residential use, no longer just for commercial. Waste water treatment plants that... are being advertised. I mean, I don't know how effective and efficient these are, but they're being advertised out there by the private sector to say, if you buy this, we can make sure that you have clean water all of the time.
Is the ANC simply, is it interested in growth? Or does it think, does it know, does it buy the argument for growth? Or Or is it completely overwhelmed by the argument for redress?
I don't know. I mean, they talk about growth, but maybe it's somebody needs to sell them the idea that, you know, when you have a growing economy, actually you've got enough to steal.
Yes, yes, yes.
So the opportunities,
yes,
you know, for
yes, create more economy. Yeah.
Yeah. Maybe listen, then they will buy that argument that you must grow the economy, then yeah, you've got a lot that you can then extract for your benefit and those of your cronies. Maybe then they will go for growth. Perhaps they don't buy the argument that we need to grow the economy to create jobs.
Listen, there's a lot of talk also come every budget time about fiscal rules, right? So, and it's very dark stuff for me. You know what my limitations are. Fiscal rules, and I think we've got an informal fiscal rule now where we on, and it's the level of debt to GDP ratio that we chase. I think it's about 75%. Proving quite hard to meet. We keep saying this is our target, and we keep missing it. What do you think about these targets? Are they a good thing?
As the EU chaps discovered as well some years ago, they can be a problem. You can end up sort of shoving them aside for a while whilst you've got problems to address. But the problem with rules is that it doesn't help to put a rule if you're not going to stick to it. It's like, I mean, a school principal saying school starts at 8 o'clock. Then if you allow students to start waltzing in at 9 o'clock, you know, what's the point of the rule that school starts at 8 kind of thing, right?
Yeah.
So yes, they are useful. I mean, if you're going to stick to them, right? But sticking to them does, come with challenges, particularly when you are facing, let's say, the COVID-19 pandemic, for example. But usually, financial markets are tolerant or understanding of those major sort of external events that may hit you, and then you need to go above. Or bend the rule to accommodate that shock to the economy, but it can't just be then. The rule is a movable feast.
No, but we also seem to sort of trap ourselves. You know, what if we were to redefine what debt is? You know, so we borrow now to pay salaries, right? And we borrow to build. We borrow to build, but basically we're borrowing now for operational expenses, cars, security, ministerial apartments in Cape Town or whatever they may be. What if we were to redefine our spending so that we can cap, you know, we pay for salaries and operational stuff out of tax revenue, but then we can also borrow for capital spending. That doesn't have to become immediately debt because ultimately it's going to earn a return. So take the infrastructure program. I mean, if you borrow to fund the state share of a joint venture with the private sector, say to build a bridge or a school, does that have to reflect as debt, even though there's going to be a return on it? That's what seems to be the case now.
Well, the rules of kind of putting together finances obviously are governed by kind of internationally accepted prescripts, if you like. I mean, there's a way of classifying expenditures and kind of things that will be kind of regulated by the UN, IMF, World Bank. They will kind of say, well, if you do this, it falls under that. So because then that allows not only for, well, primarily it allows for easy or relatively easy comparison of finances across kind of globally. I mean, if we're all using relatively the same kind of classification of expenditure and revenue, right? The problem, Peter, is more on the expenditure side in my view, in the sense that if you borrow money to pay for infrastructure, to let's say you are building Gusile, right? The big power station or Medupi. Look, if you borrow all of this money, you go and build the power plant, and 10, 15 years later, it's still not fully operational. I mean, that's not good expenditure of money. So priority, in my view, should be on, how do we make our expenditure efficient and effective, particularly on infrastructure. Yeah. Right?
So what about if you keep the budgeting process more accountable, right? So, you know, in the wake of this budget, in the wake of the VAT fuss, there's now these calls for it to be a people's budget process, and that may just be the rhetoric of the day. But in big economies like the UK, for instance, there's a thing called, and I know there's a parliamentary budget office in South Africa, but I'm not sure what its role is, and you can help me here. But in big economies like the UK, they have a thing called the Office of Budget Responsibility, OBR. And it's got a pretty wide and robust duty of comment, you know, and it's a watchdog. It really is a watchdog. It publishes detailed five-year forecasts for the economy, which accompany the UK budget and the Chancellor's spring statement. They publish their own projections of GDP growth, tax income, et cetera, et cetera. And if chancellors and, you know, ignore these things, they can have a really hard time, as Liz Truss and her Chancellor Kwasi Kwarteng discovered about 3 years ago, when they ignored the budget of they didn't consult it, and brought out, you know, a budget that the markets just rebelled against, and they both lost their jobs. We don't have a watchdog that tough, do we?
Well, because historically, I mean, as I was saying earlier, that the Parliamentary Budget Office hasn't really kind of been effective in that sense. So this is perhaps the first time that it has an opportunity to come.
What has it been doing? I haven't been following it. I mean, what is the Parliamentary Budget Office doing now in this crisis?
It produced, based on what I read the other day, it did produce a report on what the minister was proposing, particularly over the March budget. So whether then the parliament took that into account in looking at the fiscal framework, I'm not sure to what extent it grew extensively or to some extent from that. But it's meant to help parliament come to grips with whatever the Minister of Finance is proposing on revenue and expenditure and how to finance.
Perhaps there are ways to strengthen it. You know, the Office of Budget Responsibility in the UK also reviews the treasury, also reviews treasury cost estimates for tax and welfare policy. So imagine the effect here, because when we produced the Bella Act, you know, the Basic Education Amendment Act, it introduced a thing called Grade R. And there was an actual, for the first, very rare costing attached to it, but nobody had paid any attention. So the finance minister had to go out of his way and suddenly find a whole lot of money, a few hundred billion, if I'm not mistaken, to introduce a whole new year in schools. And you would have thought that there'd be a real outcry from that, because any Office of Budget Responsibility or Parliamentary Budget Office would surely say, excuse me, this has not been taken care of yet. You haven't addressed this. Where's the money for this? Where's the, you know, if we make legislation and laws without putting a cost to them, surely that's just asking for trouble. And I don't hear calls for account for, you know, neither the DA, certainly not the ANC, seem to want this, but it seems to me to be so obvious. You know, you don't want to stop the government from functioning, but you do want the public to know what it's, you know, what it thinks it can do and what an independent institution, an independent state or institution thinks it can do. And where they're different, who's going to be
most definitely. I mean, the question becomes also the structure of the Parliamentary Budget Office, and particularly in terms of where it sits. Is it bound by the same kind of hiring rules as for Parliament, because there might be limitations in terms of its ability to recruit.
Yeah. Maybe it shouldn't be in Parliament. Maybe it should be independent, out of Parliament.
Top-notch economist. Well, if it's in the same way that when Pravin arrived, took over SARS and was building SARS, he negotiated that SARS be negotiate its working conditions and salaries separately from the rest of government, right? So you might want to ring fence the parliamentary budget office, in other
words.
Yeah,
well, exactly,
From the hiring practices of parliament, and then you might be able to, and obviously then resource it properly in terms of finances as well.
Jabulani, we're going to have to leave it there. Thank you so much for joining me. I really appreciate it. I really appreciate your time, and it's lovely to hear from you after all these years. Thank you all for listening. I hope that was useful. I'll be back soon with another edition of Podcasts from the Edge. Until then, please take care. Keep safe. Bye-bye.